Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Sunday morning wake-up call. It's snowing outside. Did you know that? I know that. And, you know what? Don't go out on the road if you don't know how. People from Boston can go out on the road. People from Canada can go out on the road. People from Charlottesville can go out on the road if you know how to drive. But don't go out on the road now to get your milk and your bread. Let the people who are spreading the salt go out on the road. But otherwise, just hang out and enjoy your Sunday. Baking a beautiful cake. Baking a pretty... planning your pretty Christmas treats and otherwise enjoying the holiday December snows. Today, our plan is to talk about immigration and the migrant caravan that we heard so much about in the last couple weeks. Our guest today, we have Kristen Claren. She's a local activist who does pro bono work with asylum seekers. We have Dina Sharuk. She's an immigration attorney with the Legal Aid Justice Center. She also teaches immigration law at the UVA School of Law. And Harriet Kaur, who's the executive director at Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
That's so much smarts and talent in the room at one time. Usually when it's just me and Dan in here, there's this vacuum. Well, not when Dan's here. So, one at a time. Kristen.
Yep.
The local activist. Dan, there's this horrible sound. Kristen.
Yes.
You're welcome to say hello.
Hi, everybody.
I want Dan to hear that and with his tell us, a local activist who does pro bono work with asylum seekers.
Yep.
Use your theater stage voice for me, please.
Hi, everybody. I'm better now.
Just keep chatting. I want to know, you recently went to Tijuana, correct?
Yep, I just came back on Thursday. There was a team of about 18 people from the area who went down to support people trying to seek asylum at the border in Tijuana.
And you've done pro bono work on what other...
We were lucky in Charlottesville to be able to sponsor as a community some members of last spring's caravan, so I've helped them coordinate their legal representation here and just sort of generally get their affairs in order after they left Central America and crossed the border and were detained for several months and then were paroled out and supported by members of this community and then others more further afield.
Now, some people have already forgotten about last spring's caravan.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about last spring's caravan. What was that group and what was the eventual result of that or of those folks?
I think last year's caravan was pretty much like this year's caravan and that this is a phenomenon that's happening for a while. It's not safe in most of the parts of Central America where these people are fleeing, and so they do like humans have done since the beginning of our species and band together for safety in numbers. Last year's caravan, like this year's caravan, had a few groups of distinct people, people who are fleeing discrimination based on their sexual preferences. And so that there was a subgroup of that last year, and there is this year too, and that's a particularly, excuse me, I caught whatever is going around to you, Anna. This is a particularly vulnerable group of people, as are the unaccompanied kids that came up on last year's caravan and this year's caravan too, children who had to leave their parents and come up on their own to seek safety.
And what was the ending result of those folks? Were they allowed into the United States? Were they turned away? Were they, did something happen with that group that led to how this caravan is being treated?
I mean, probably our president's increased reaction for political purposes is the difference between last year's caravan and this year's caravan. Nothing has happened with those people in any sense because the asylum process is not a quick one. They came to the border. They asked for protection from our country. They were detained in many cases in the way that our country detains people at the border, and then they were paroled out, and now they are seeking asylum through the legal processes in our country, just as our government has promised people in the international community that they're able to do. So it's not a finished process for them. It's not a finished process. It's a process that hasn't even been able to start for most of the people at the border in Tijuana right now.
That's Kristen Claren. She's a local activist doing pro bono work with asylum seekers. We also have with us Dina Sharuk, who's an immigration attorney with the Legal Aid Justice Center and teaching immigration law at UVA School of Law. We have Harriet Kaur, the executive director at Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee. Dina, people think that the immigration law has recently or mostly changed in the Trump administration. Is that true?
I mean, that's a good question. When we're talking about refugee and asylum law, a great deal of it has already been legislated, so the only way to change it would be through Congress, what has been legislated. What we have seen on the ground largely are policy changes by the Trump administration. So when we hear about executive orders, those are usually changes in policy, but they can't change the law that's already on the books. So when we talk about asylum, it's legal to come to the border and request asylum at a port of entry. That's a completely legal process, and we are bound by both our laws domestically and our international treaties to actually go through and see whether or not people actually qualify for asylum. So it's a good question. The laws themselves haven't really been changed. The laws on the books in terms of what Congress has done, but we have seen a great deal of change in terms of policy, and some of those policies have been challenged.
When you say they've been challenged by whom?
Sure, so different advocacy groups. We've seen, I mean, the Legal Aid Justice Center ourselves, we've done some challenges to different policies. But if I'm thinking more recently, we've seen the Trump administration make an effort to ban people from claiming asylum if they didn't enter the United States with permission. So there have been challenges to that, and there's currently what we call an injunction. So what that means like is a hold on the government being able to implement that change, because the court has said while this case is pending, we've decided you cannot implement this policy. So what we have on the books is that regardless of somebody's status, whether they came to the border or whether they and requested it from a border officer, or if they entered the United States without permission, or if they flew into the United States with a different visa, no matter what your status is, you have the ability to request asylum within a year of your entry to the United States. Those are the laws that we have on the books here in the U.S.
Dina Sharuk, an attorney at Legal Aid Justice Center and at UVA's law school. Harriet Kaur is with us today as well, director at Charlottesville's IRC, the International Rescue Committee. I'm curious, you see individuals and families who are being aided, assisted by the International Rescue Committee. For 2 years now, the Trump administration has been, I mean, from within days of taking over, the first policy attempt was put through about the Muslim countries. And now we're here today talking about the caravan, immigration caravan. Is the Muslim caravan just another something being done, or has the concern and the trauma continuing to rise or fall that you see by these people and families at the IRC is assisting?
So traditionally, our work at the IRC, we've been doing refugee resettlement, which is a kind of a separate but kind of parallel process. So the refugee program is where people are vetted and approved, and their status is determined outside the country, right? So in a lot of ways, someone who's seeking asylum and a refugee are kind of on parallel tracks. Just a refugee's status is determined outside the country, and then they're allowed to enter the U.S. with that status and as an immigrant, whereas an asylum seeker is someone who enters the U.S., requests asylum, and then their status is determined while they're already in the U.S. So, I mean, there's kind of a whole discussion that, about, like, the caravan, whether, you know, I only wonder this. Like, I haven't actually read anything about this, but in a sense, they could almost be considered, like, in asylum in Mexico. It would be very interesting if, like, the UN or someone stepped in and kind of started processing them as refugees and kind of, you know, that's an alternative system. And then in our work at the IRC, we traditionally have not been able to use any of our kind of public funding or anything to support asylum seekers. But once someone was granted asylum, they then can come to us and get more or less the same services that a refugee can get. But what's interesting is with all of what's going on is the IRC is an organization kind of outside our traditional role of refugee resettlement. We have been getting more involved in kind of raising awareness. We've on a fairly modest level, have been providing some services to some of the families who have made it to Charlottesville as asylum seekers using non-government funds, non-public funding, using private funding to kind of assist them in ways that we can, if they can get here, if they can make it here. And we also have some of our offices, like in Phoenix and Tucson that are in San Diego that are down toward the border that have been sending staff to help as well.
I guess one of my questions, though, is even once you're a refugee, it only takes an executive order for your status to be changed.
Once you're in, you're in. I think that's, you know, after the election, well, the inauguration, and then the first executive order on immigration was like a week later. You know, in those first weeks, we actually met with a lot of our clients last winter. Was it how long ago was it? a year and a half ago. And one of the messages we were saying is, if you're here, you're fine. They've already been granted a status that puts them on the path to citizenship. That I don't think that can be altered at this point. I mean, there's other issues that are bubbling up, like the public charge issues, and things like that. Trying to even for people who are here legally and currently legally entitled to certain public benefits, trying to take those away from them or make them ineligible for legal permanent residency and citizenship if they took advantage of those. There is still a waiver in effect for refugees and asylees on those that could theoretically be challenged in the future, but so far has not. So, you know, our message for people, if you're here safely, you know, you're okay, and we're, you know, we're going to do everything we can to protect your rights. And I think that's less of a risk. Most of our families that are here are worried about their families that are still back wherever that they hope will come and rejoin them and now cannot.
Rick, I think what we should probably also discuss is the definition of what a refugee is, because sometimes we think that we're talking about refugees when we might not necessarily be, because, you know, your question made me think about people with temporary protected status, for example, and that's something that we've seen largely challenged these days.
Which proves that I didn't know how to properly phrase my question.
No, no, I mean, I think it's actually normal to think of people with temporary protective status as refugees.
I'm the guy on the street who didn't know how to ask that question well, so please.
Well, so when we talk about refugees and asylees, what we're talking about are people who in their home country have a well-founded fear of persecution on the basis of their race, religion, national origin, social group, or political opinion. So it's not just anybody who is living in, let's say, Syria and is living in a tough area where bombs are being dropped, for example, can come to the United States and claim asylum here or get designated as a refugee abroad by UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. It's somebody who's specifically been targeted because of one of those five protected grounds. So when we talk about refugees, we're talking about those individuals. But for example, there are other humanitarian forms of protection here in the United States, such as temporary protected status. And those are for people who, when the United States wishes to protect people from a particular country that's gone through some sort of either civil strife or environmental damage, like a hurricane, or a good example would be Nepal's earthquake in Nepal. What they can do is say, people who are from Nepal who are currently in the United States, they can remain here for a period of time until Nepal is able to get things in order. So what we have seen from the Trump administration is this effort to walk back the countries who are currently on that list. And, you know, that's up to the executive, so the president, to decide which countries are on the list and which countries get taken off the list at any given time. So that's an example of a humanitarian protection that we have here in the U.S. that has, we have seen people who are already here, they might lose that protection.
And I know, can I also say, a lot of times when I talk to groups, I use a visual for myself, and it's, you know, we use the word refugee colloquially in so many ways, and then there's also this refugee status as a legal term. So I always say it's like refugee with a little r and refugees with a capital R. And so when I'm talking with you, I'm talking about capital R refugees with a certain status. But, you know, in the press, in the media, you'll see like the entire caravan referred to as refugees. They're migrants. They're people fleeing. The reasons for their flight and what category they might eventually fall into has not yet been determined.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, real quick, we need to take our first break. What is the legal definition of asylum rights? It seems to fall into that category, and you were just down in Tijuana working with the asylum.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear just from this conversation here between all of us that it's a tricky issue, and there's a lot of vernacular and things that, like you said, the average person on the street in the United States doesn't necessarily understand the differences in these definitions and the status. And the really kind of heartbreaking aspect to this is that neither do the migrants that are fleeing persecution. And so one of the majority of what we were doing on the ground is talking to people waiting, you know, for some of whom were about to have their number called to cross into the United States within minutes, talking to them about the nature of their claims and how and whether or not they are likely to have a successful asylum case in the United States and what that would mean for them in terms of future deportation and how that process will unfold for them. So it's a really difficult job to do on the border.
Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I want to talk about the asylum rights. I want to talk about what happened in Tijuana, where mm-hmm. you were just there, and get some stories about that. Again, our guest today, as we talk about immigration, the Migrant Caravan, with Harriet Kaur, the executive director of Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee, Kristen Clarence. She's an activist doing pro bono work with asylum seekers, and Dina Sharuk, an immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center, as well as teaching immigration law at UVA's School of Law. Okay, here we are back. I'm fascinated. So that means you are too. With our guests, Kristen and Dina and Harriet. I wanted to get the definition of, is there an official definition of legal asylum rights? I mean, again, I don't want to go too deep into the weeds. I don't want my definition 18.C.A. But is there something that's one or two sentences and something that you need to meet to qualify?
Sure. So, Rick, earlier we said that a refugee, for example, is somebody outside of the United States who has been persecuted or has a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or social group. The difference between a refugee and an asylee is somebody who's actually made it into the United States and requested that they be designated a refugee. So the difference is somebody can be designated a refugee abroad and then go through the process to legally come to the United States. Or they can come to the United States and request asylum, and that is essentially asking to be assessed as a refugee here in the United States. So that's the big difference. And in terms of what we offer people with asylum, what we've said is if you get asylum here in the United States, you have a pathway to a green card and later perhaps citizenship, so long as you meet certain requirements.
And Kristen, that's why you went to Tijuana, is all these people mm-hmm. who are being told, don't come in and ask from inside the United States, stay outside and ask. Correct?
Well, I think that actually it's not really about what they're being told here. It's about fleeing circumstances of pretty serious danger in their home countries. And so they don't know this. I mean, no one outside of the legal community really understands the ins and outs.
So they're not, in the caravan, they're not stopping to read the newspaper along the way.
No, most of them are, I mean, they don't have access to internet. They don't have access or extra cash to buy newspapers. It's been one of the most eye-opening experiences over the past few months as I've worked in two detention facilities, one of which was doing family reunification and one of which had the largest group of unaccompanied minors in the world. The people have no idea that they're in the middle of this whirlwind of news and that they are being played in these ways politically. They didn't leave their countries with any understanding of how their cases would fall under any type of remedies that they might seek here. They left because they're in danger. And so one of the things that we do that I feel most committed to is working with people as they're about to present themselves and ask for protection from our government. They're not even sure what the terms of protection might be or how to characterize their cases. They just know that they want help. And so sometimes the work we do is talking to them about the criteria for asylum and realizing that actually they're not going to qualify, that for whatever reason, the type of violence or the type of suffering that they're enduring is not protected by international law or by our domestic law. And so talking to them, counseling them about potential next steps, which could include, in the case of Mexico, some humanitarian relief that their government is offering, notably not in Tijuana, but further south in the country. So that was a big part of what we did last week.
How did this caravan end up in Tijuana if they didn't read the paper? I mean, I'm sorry, I'm being slightly smart, but How did they know to go there?
Well,
based on what that's what the U.S. government was saying, was to go to that port of entry.
No, I don't think. Well, you know, maybe some people in the government did. The caravan convened in Mexico City, and then while they were there, like I was sort of alluding to earlier, there are different factions within the caravan, and actually three different groups that had sort of joined together. And they, the biggest part of the group made a decision quickly to push north to Tijuana because the other ports of entry are less safe. Getting from Mexico City to the other ports of entry through those parts of Mexico involves more risk to people that even, you know, a huge chunk of thousands of people traveling together couldn't overcome. So they went to Tijuana for relative safety. And now the city of Tijuana is sort of precariously hanging in the balance in terms of safety itself.
Again, our guests today, Harriet Kaur, Dina Sharuk, Kristen Clarins, as we talk about immigration and the migrant caravan here on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Sunday morning wake-up call. Thank you so much for being with us today. 27 minutes after the hour. Is this discussion of immigration, we always seem focused on Southern Hispanics. And occasionally, or before, we were just always focused on Muslim. Is that because European doesn't seem to bother the current the current administration? Or the numbers aren't bothersome?
I think that what we've seen in terms of rhetoric has been a disfavoring of certain groups. I think we've heard some very obvious animus towards people who are Hispanic. We've heard some obvious animus against people from the Middle East and people who are Muslim, and we've heard animus against Haiti as well as certain African nations. So I don't think there's a real question as to how the executive branch feels about people coming from those continents, those countries.
Do we have? I mean, does anybody know the European numbers or percentages as part of the total?
Well, those numbers are available, but I think it's a question of what we're asking. If we're asking about who refugees are, that changes depending on, you know, geopolitical politics on the ground throughout the world. And that changes from time to time what refugees look like, where they come from. But in terms of different types of immigration, so family-based claims or employment-based claims, we see a variety, and oftentimes our immigration system, for better or for worse, tries to limit certain countries from sending too many people as an effort to kind of keep immigration level with respect to who is entering and where they're coming from.
Harriet, can you talk to that question in terms of Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee?
About where people are coming from? Or, so,
I mean, because all we ever hear in the news is the complaint about Southern Hispanics. I mean, people coming from Mexico and South or Muslim. That's all we ever hear a complaint about.
I think you're being tongue-in-cheek about kind of people coming from Europe. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine, but if we're talking about claims of persecution, and I think, you know, obviously people in Europe would just go to another country in Europe probably if they were having issues. But when the kind of quote-unquote Muslim ban, which theoretically is not supposed to impact refugees but does, when they first came out with the list of countries, if you looked at that, those countries represented 48% of the refugees who, in the last few years, had been entering. So that was a impact on the refugee resettlement program. Pretty much who's getting through now as refugees mostly are Congolese. So we still have a lot of Congolese refugees who have fled their country from the ongoing civil conflicts there and are living in other kind of Central and East African countries that and have been in camps and things for like over 10 years there. We're seeing a few families get through. But, you know, there's other things, other kind of non-public policies that the administration has undertaken to continue to gut the refugee resettlement program, mostly administrative tactics that don't even come to the level of being publicized, that, you know, just reassigning staff and, you know, and things like that that have really slowed the refugee entry program to a trickle.
Harriet Kaur from the Charlottesville International Rescue Committee. Kristen?
Yeah.
Kristen Clarence, who went down to Tijuana to help the asylum seekers, you mentioned that you had seen families being torn apart. Talk about that for a minute.
To be sort of clear, I didn't see them being torn apart because I was on the Mexican side of things, and so they would leave Mexico and go into a processing facility. Our concern and in our understanding of what was happening on the other side, where people are supporting migrants in the detention process and the legal process on our side, we would meet a lot of parents who had children who were born in the United States. So they had what we were calling mixed families in terms of mixed citizenship. Families who are from Honduras or from Guatemala with an American child for throughout the course of their family's lives. I had spent some time here in the past. And in those cases, the parents were normally detained after they crossed. And during the course of their detention, the child, the American child, was taken into custody by foster care, in this case, the state of California. And the concern and what's been happening is that the parents haven't been able to leave the detention facility to go to the custodial hearings in the foster care system. So while they're detained, they actually lose custody of their children because they can't attend the hearings and indicate to the court that they want to maintain, you know, retain their custodial rights. So that's one of the ways. And in the other instances, children who are over a certain age, usually around 10 or 12, are separated in the processing facilities. Routinely, they're separated from their parents for a matter of days, which, you know, in the context of looking back where we were in June, being separated from a parent being separated from their kids for only 3 days seems a lot better than it was in June and July, which was like an indefinite detention situation that was really difficult for us to kind of put back the puzzle to be put back together at the end. The kids are still being regularly separated for a few days as their parents are processed and their next steps are determined.
And what's important to note about that is these are individuals who are fleeing extreme violence and have oftentimes gone through a great deal of trauma. So if you imagine somebody fleeing to a place where they believe they can get some sort of refuge, some sort of protection, and then having their child ripped from them, the effects of that, especially on somebody who has been previously traumatized, are particularly harmful. We were seeing people on the ground who were having what we call credible fear interviews. So at the border, you're interviewed to see whether or not you have a credible fear in your home country, of persecution in your home country. And people had just had their children ripped from them, and they were not able to function during those credible fear interviews. And, you know, as a result, the Legal Aid Justice Center took action and brought a suit regarding that matter and found a way to have people get another opportunity to have those interviews. But the government was failing people in those interviews after, you know, traumatizing them all over again by taking their children away and giving them no indication of whether they would see those children again.
Yeah. I think it's really the part that's been sort of most horrifying to me about this entire thing is just how little the people understand about these policies that are affecting them so seriously. So, for instance, a lot of 16 and 17-year-olds will leave their home countries, and they are detained for months and months regularly. There is really no other option for them because we cannot let an unaccompanied minor into our country without parental supervision. So they have to be detained, but they will be there for months and still not understand what's happening. So sometimes I was on one of the first legal teams in this unaccompanied minor facility, and the kids would come in and ask me if I was giving them a visa. There's no visa. There is no visa in that process for them. And they had been there for 7 or 8 months and still didn't understand the nature of the detention, the nature of the sponsor that they were waiting for, what their future held. So it was a pretty, pretty grave moment for me.
What about, some of the, when someone who is against this whole process didn't want to let these asylum seekers into the country was saying, These aren't parents with their kids. These are criminals who are just bringing these kids with them so that they can get into the country. Did you see anyone like this? Is this one or two people who, one or two incidents where this might actually be happening?
I didn't see a single instance that could even be, no, there was nothing that, you can't fake that. People are always like, are you sure that people weren't lying? Are you sure that they weren't? And I had this one really difficult interview with a woman who I was, like Dina was saying, trying to organize her thoughts so that she could present herself for a credible fear interview in a way that was like slightly less traumatized. And we were just trying to talk through some of her facts. And I said, how many kids do you have in your home country? And she told me that she had 2 kids. And we spent 45 minutes together prepping her, what persecution she suffered and the nature of all of the risks. And the next day she came back crying and said, I lied to you yesterday because I actually have 3 kids, but I didn't want you to judge me when I told you that I had to leave one at home because I could only carry 2. And she was also 6 months pregnant. So if we want to talk about, lying, and I'm doing air quotes here for those of you listening, I just can't imagine that we've become that cruel and heartless of a country that we want to be characterizing lying in that way, or just or shutting ourselves off to stories like that.
Without being too cynical, I think it's a common tactic in which you look at a system that you don't like, you look for incidences of abuse of that system, and then you try to apply it to a whole.
Yeah.
I'm sure at some point somebody has done something like that, where they maybe brought a child and tried to use that child. But to paint groups of fleeing refugee families in that light is, it's a political tactic used to eliminate a system.
You take one.
Take one instance.
And blame 10,000.
Exactly.
Again, our guest today, Dina Sharouk. She's an immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center. You just heard speak. She also teaches immigration law at UVA Law School. We have Harriet Kaur here. She's the executive director at Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee. We also have Kristen Clarins, who's the local activist doing pro bono work, who was down in Tijuana with the asylum seekers doing work down there. Let's take our next break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about this fascinating, scary, unbelievable stories that are going on with immigration and the migrant caravan. Hang tight. Okay, back in action here. I hope you're enjoying the snow outside, because the conversation inside is fascinating. Our guests today, again, Ms. Clarins, Ms. Sharouk, Ms. Kaur. One of the things that has been said is that, let me see if I can find my place, is does waitlisting the people for weeks at a time encourage them to take their chances crossing illegally, often paying thousands of dollars to smugglers for help? Let's do this one at a time. Kristen, you were just down there in Tijuana. Your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on what we're calling the metering process is that it's going to lead to people. People are going to start dying. It's cold and it's rainy, and thousands of people are living outside. They don't have a roof. So when it rains, there's an immediate need for new tents and new sleeping bags and new clothing, because there are no roofs big enough to house this entire caravan. And you can hear from my voice, I'm sick with the same thing that every other person, especially the children in Tijuana, have right now. They're not going to make it through the winter without some support. And so, you know, does it encourage them to go across, like, you know, again, air quotes, illegally? I'm not sure, but it's not legal what we're doing with this metering and only accepting a few handful of people every day. And just to set the scene, because I think this is important, every single morning, hundreds of families will show up at the port of entry, and there's a list being maintained by the migrants at the request of our government, which is a bizarre sort of delegation of an authority that should be being done by our government, and only a few numbers are called. It's kind of like if you go to a bakery and you're trying to buy cookies or something, and you're just like super hopeful that your little piece of paper gets called, except for the consequences are much more serious in this case, and there's no telling whether they're going to call two families or whether they're going to call 100, and then they just keep showing up every day. That's not the system that is that we're compelled to follow under international law. And so what that's going to result in is, I'm not sure how it's going to change the decisions of the migrants about their futures, but it is going to change their health and their safety over the course of the winter on the streets of Tijuana.
Dina, I'd like you to, one, to define metering for those who don't know everything. I did a little bit of my homework for the show. And then your thoughts on this concept that people have talked about that I read about making people... is making people wait, causing more people to enter illegally?
Sure. I mean, so to define metering, it's not a new concept, this idea that, you know, over, I mean, I think the numbers show that over 100,000 people try to come to the United States at the border, at the ports of entry each day. So that's... What we often do is, as Kristen kind of mentioned it, is give people a spot in line and say, we're going to let this many people in today, and tomorrow we'll address how many we'll let in. But what's happened with under this administration is that the metering has gotten a bit more aggressive. We've seen less people be allowed in each day. And when we think about the caravan, we think, if we're talking about 100,000 people coming each day or trying to gain entry through a port of entry each day, and we think about the size of this caravan as being 5,000, it's an interesting debate that we're having. Another point is that, you know, there's the saying about those who fail to learn history are doomed to repeat it. The reason why we have a refugee convention internationally, and the reason why the United States participates, is that back, you know, during the Holocaust, when Jewish Europeans came to the United States and sought refuge, there's a famous story of a ship coming to the United States and us turning them away, and many of them being sent back to Europe and, you know, being killed in the Holocaust. When we signed on to the 1967 protocol, so when we signed on to offer refuge to people fleeing persecution in home country, we did so with an understanding that we didn't want something like this to happen again. So when we're turning people at the border away saying, we won't let you in today, we're forced to kind of think back on our history and think, you know, Kristen made the point, people will die if they're not allowed to find refuge somewhere. And we have to ask ourselves what our values are as a nation, whether or not we're okay with that.
Harriet, I want to get your thoughts on this. What a lot of people would say, I mean, part of my job here during the show is play a little bit of devil's advocate, is they don't have any tents. Where are the non-profits? Get some tents down there. But they still have to wait their turn. That's what International Rescue Committee should be doing, or others like them.
Yeah, so I think I know for IRC, what we have done is we've actually opened an office in El Salvador and are working with displaced people there, trying to give them assistance and protection to whether they're from El Salvador, they've kind of come in from other countries. But that's the step that our organization has taken. I think that's an interesting question about Mexico. I think some of it is just time, and also, of course, the government of Mexico has to request, you know, has to be seeking assistance. And I think that, you know, that things are sort of slowed in this chess game between the U.S. and Mexico, and putting the U.S.'s responsibility back on a neighboring country. And there actually are ongoing negotiations, and I suspect that something like that will happen. But you know, I think it's very canny of us to say, well, it's Mexico's fault. They should step up, you know. Because really what should be happening is people should be being able to kind of be processed through temporarily to the United States. I think, you know, there's a couple really key points here. And one is that, again, we said this earlier in the show, but arriving at a port of entry and requesting asylum is not illegal, right? That is a legal act. And that what, you know, if we were following normal procedures, we should be, you know, people should be having their credible fear hearings, come in, and then they're released to make their actual asylum application. If they get to their, you know, their hearing and their claim is justified, they are granted asylum. If not, it's not, and they're deported, and that's legal. We're not disagreeing with that. We're just saying people have the right to come and ask to be heard. But then, you know, if they were in the U.S., they would have access to, I think, to nonprofits and other organizations. But yeah, it's the politics right now between the U.S. and Mexico are tricky. Yeah.
I have a quote here, actually, from the director of immigration with the IRC. While the administration is saying people should come here legally and follow a legal process, the administration is making it impossible to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're. I mean, in a sense, the U.S. we're taking steps to obstruct both our own laws and international law.
Can somebody? I don't know. I guess this question goes to the three of you. What has happened in Mexico that is allowing for the caravan to actually hold in Tijuana? What happened? And why did Mexico agree to let the caravan stay there? I mean, previously, Mexico and the leadership in Mexico and the leadership and at the White House were butting heads. And now they seem to be agreeing enough to let this take place.
I'm not an expert on this. The last thing I read was, I mean, they're in the process of a leadership change in Mexico.
Yeah.
So I think part of what's happening in Mexico is like they're in the middle of a government change, and so I think they're sort of waiting for the new president and leadership to come in to kind of figure out what the next steps are. So I think it's an awkward time for that country as well right now.
I think we've also seen the mayor of Tijuana, for a variety of reasons, request humanitarian assistance on a global level, mm-hmm. which is what a lot of people who are focused on the human rights abuses and humanitarian crisis factors, aspects of what's happening in Tijuana, are saying that this actually shouldn't be characterized in an immigration debate or even a political debate between Mexico and the United States, that this sort of rises to a level that needs more, like Dina and Harriet were saying, we need more United Nations support or more global support to make sure that this crisis is managed in a way that protects lives and keeps people secure. But it is worth noting that the tide has really shifted in Tijuana, and the people in Tijuana want a more tenable situation there's a lot of, I think, kind of budding violence between Tijuana residents who want life to go back to normal, the migrants who certainly do not want to overwinter in wet tents on the street, and the sort of fledgling nonprofits on the ground there who are totally overwhelmed. I think to your point earlier, previous caravans or influx of migrants have spread out through the different ports of entry across the southern United States. And this year, it was a little bit unusual for everyone to concentrate in the way they did in Tijuana. And so last year, you know, there was like a sort of broader disbursement. And this year, to have this many people in one port of entry is stressing a city. Tijuana didn't have an awesome reputation before this for pretty good reason. And it's a stressful place to be right now. And so I think the people in Tijuana and the government of Tijuana would like support in recasting this whole thing as a humanitarian problem rather than just one of a failed immigration system and a political problem between two countries.
I think we will see probably in the weeks to come something coming. I mean, first of all, they have to even figure out, like, even if you created like a refugee camp or something, you have to figure out where to put it. That place would have to agree to, you know, there's still a lot of like things that would have to happen to allow that to occur. But I think once some framework was put in place, the international NGOs would step up. But we're not even at that point yet.
Again, our guests today, Kristen Clarence, Dina Sharuk, and Harriet Kaur, as we talk about immigration and the migrant caravan with just a few moments left. Kristen, can you tell me a specific story that caught your attention while you were in Tijuana? Was there something that comes to mind that you saw and returned with and were telling all your friends and colleagues about?
I haven't had a chance to talk to too many friends and colleagues since I just got back, and it was a hard trip. But one of the things that's most difficult is that the unaccompanied kids can't get their names on the list. Like this list that we're talking about with like the bread tickets or whatever, they can't get their names on this list. And so they are kind of locked in this indefinite waiting pattern in Tijuana. And there are some really good sort of like hostels where they're being kept safe, but it's not a long-term solution. And so a group of advocates presented themselves to the U.S. border with these children and were actually like physically removed by U.S. immigration authorities to put them back on Mexican territory and called Mexican immigration to remove them. So to me, to see that where there's just basically complete checkmate, like there's no way for these kids to ask asylum. We've completely shut the doors to a very vulnerable population and actually colluding our government and the Mexican government together to prevent people from seeking safety. To me, that was a new level of kind of like, you know, shock. I was shocked to see that and really dismayed to think about the next steps for these kids.
Do we know any current poll numbers, whether from the people, the United States citizens, as to what's going on that might then drive our leadership? I mean, it's one thing to have the president Trump doing something, but now that we have a new House of Representatives, it might fight back a little bit. So do we know what our current people on the streets might be saying? We know poll numbers.
You know, I don't know recent poll numbers, but I think it's very interesting because if you go back and look over our history as a nation and refugee crises. I mean, the majority of Americans were against bringing European refugees in after World War II. The majority, a significant majority of Americans were against allowing Vietnamese and other East Asians in after the end of the Vietnam War. And, you know, so I think basing this kind of thing on popular appeal is really a mistake. The difference is in the past, we had bipartisan leadership always stood up and came forward on the role of this country as a haven for, you know, the most vulnerable people and really took the lead. And then, you know, over time, people kind of got used to it. And what's interesting now is when they do polls on like kind of refugee issues, I think it's still never an overly popular issue. But we actually are seeing more of a larger percentage of the population stand up on these issues than in our history. But now our leadership has gone against. It's really the first time that we've ever seen from either party that this kind of resistance to legal immigration.
Dina, I'm curious, when you teach in the classroom, you're teaching the law, but is this a class that people choose, or is this a required course? And so that may tell me what the students think.
Sure. This is a class that students can elect to take, so it's an elective course. Both the Immigration Law Clinic and the Refugee and Asylum, the domestic Refugee and Asylum Law course, are electives at the law school. So we teach the law, and I teach the law during those classes. And in the Immigration Law Clinic, students get to be paired up with individuals who need representation, and actually, I supervise the representation of those clients with those students.
All right, just a minute left before we go out. Harriet, how can people help the IRC?
So if people go to our webpage, which is easy to remember, it's rescue.org, and we have a whole section on there that talks about the crisis at the border, and the caravan explains a lot of the issues. There's a lot of information, and then obviously there's a way to donate towards IRC's response to that cause.
And Dina, how can people help at LJ?
LAJC, sure. The Legal Aid Justice Center's website is justiceforall.org. It's the number four for in there, so it's justiceforall.org. And people can help by volunteering. People can help by making donations, and you can certainly find us on the web.
And Kristen, mm-hmm. with the work that you're doing, how can people assist?
I think the main way people can assist is by continuing to pay attention to what's going on and to the most vulnerable populations that are suffering through aspects of this. And that's hard in today's day and age, where we're just kind of being subject to so much bad news all the time. But I think it's really important to pay attention. We worked on the ground with a very grassroots legal organization called Al Otro Lado. And they are doing really important work, and I think to the extent that people are able to support them directly, they should do so.
Thanks to the three of you for coming in today, talking about the migrant caravan and immigration. Again, our guest, Kristen Claren, she's a local activist doing pro bono work and was just down in Tijuana with the asylum seekers. Harriet Kaur, executive director at Charlottesville's International Rescue Committee. And Dina Sharuk, an immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center, teaching immigration law at UVA's School of Law. Thanks to you, to the three of you.
Thanks so much,
Rick. Thanks so much for having us.
Don't forget, Santa Claus will be making phone calls in just two Sundays from now. So let us know if you would like Santa to call your kid and remind them that they need to be good. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy the snow.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.